You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Siamo? Ok, buonasera a tutti, è sempre molto bello essere qui e sono molto contento questa volta di non tediarvi con le mie slide, soprattutto sto facendo contenti loro che non devono più combattere con le mie presentazioni e invece facciamo una chiacchierata che ho l'impressione non sarà molto seria ma sicuramente sarà molto interessante con Charles Stross, che conoscete benissimo, e quindi passo in inglese, no, I'll switch in English, of course. It's very uncommon to have the possibility to talk with a science fiction writer, which is very, his stories are very tied to science, to information technology. Grazie. Thank you. Especially, I mean, we usually think of science fiction writers as someone who forecasts the future with 20, 30, 40 years in advance, imagining things that probably will happen and sometimes will not. We are now not living in the future that was imagined by Clark, for instance, for 2001, A Space Odyssey. The actual future was quite different from that imagined 50 years ago. Yes, it's difficult to talk with this noise. I guess that writing science fiction right now is very difficult because we are living in actual science fiction. And the time you imagine a novel and the time you type your thoughts, probably your thoughts have already become reality and the things that you imagined are sold on the shelf or on eBay, on Amazon. So, imagining the future nowadays could be very different from how it was in the past. That's, the theme I would like to put on the table and to talk with Charles too, starting with a few hints, a few themes that I took from the science fiction of not very a past which is not very distant from now. First of all, I will read you a definition. I'm sure that you will soon catch what I'm referring to. I'm thinking of a consensual hallucination experienced daily by billions of legitimate operators in every nation, by children being taught mathematical concepts, a graphic representation of data abstracted from the banks of every computer in the human system, unthinkable complexity, lines of light ranged in the known space of the mind, clusters and constellations of data, like city lights, receding. Do you remember what I'm talking about? It's the definition, the first original definition of cyberspace from the novel Neuromancer, 1982. Now we are living within the actual cyberspace, which is not a science fiction concept, but is a tough reality. We live in it. We make, we buy things, we live our life, and there are people who are taking it very, very seriously. The military, for instance, we are already talking about cyber wars, wars that will be happening in the cyberspace. So a science fiction concept of just a few years ago has become a very tough reality. What do you think about?
Well, as William Gibson remarked in one of his other stories, the street finds its own use for technologies. And for the street, we could read any other section of society. And in particular, the term cyberspace itself has been co-opted and mutilated so badly by the military and by large corporations' marketing departments that these days, whenever I hear the term cyber as a prefix, I assume that the speaker is spouting bullshit. Sorry. That's not to say that it isn't a very real, very important aspect of our everyday lives, but the way this stuff impinges on us today, we've gotten used first to the original internet, the classic dial-up internet and terminal logins and Usenet news, then to the World Wide Web, and now to the post-web, I guess, cloud-mediated app ecosystem, where computer processors are abstracted into virtual processors running on huge arrays of millions of computers in giant anonymous data centers. And the relatively small, friendly-looking pocket computers that we all have, holding up an iPhone here, if you do a feature-by-feature comparison between this iPhone and a late 1990s supercomputer costing tens of millions, the iPhone trashes the supercomputer. These are astonishingly powerful pieces of equipment, and there are literally billions of them out there, of Android and iPhone machines. And they, in turn, they leak. They leak data everywhere. When you carry a smartphone, it is leaving a trail indicating where you've been with the cell phone companies who need to be able to track you just to route calls to your phone. You're leaving a trail of cookies and of other web bugs and tracking devices whenever you look at a web browser. Even worse, whenever you look at Facebook. Facebook are terrible for that. And whenever you take a photo or store some data on your phone, it is probably uploaded to the cloud, which is not an abstract thing. It is a giant network. Well, it's a giant server farm with millions of machines, with petabytes or even exabytes of storage available, backed up to other data centers and accessed over the web. Virtualization is the name of a game these days, whereby the software stack that is accepting all the uploads and providing services to your phone is virtualized in a software container that can be run on any compatible device, again, across any one of the nodes within these data centers. And these nodes in turn can leak. They can be running data centers on other continents, And there are some very disturbing side effects. A couple of days ago, Facebook, under fire because of the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which I assume you've all heard of, woke up and noticed the European Union's General Data Protection Requirement Directive, GDPR. And they are in the process of updating their terms of service and moving the home accounts of 1.5 billion Facebook users out of Ireland and into the United States, where GDPR does not apply, because GDPR would make their ability to data mine the hell out of us a little bit difficult. Some of this stuff turns around to bite us in the tail. If GDPR had been applicable to Facebook and Cambridge Analytica 5 years ago, Donald Trump wouldn't be in the White House. Brexit wouldn't be happening.
Yep. Agreed.
This is serious stuff, and yet it seems like a distant technical abstraction, a long way from our lived experience. So, yeah, we are sort of living in a science fictional future, but it's not exactly the one William Gibson predicted. We tend to think that science fiction writers predict the future, but we don't really. A famous computer scientist, Edgar Dijkstra, once said that computer science is no more about building computers than astronomy is about building big telescopes. And the same goes for science fiction. Science fiction is no more about predicting the future than astronomy is about building big telescopes. And I think that's an important point we tend to lose track of too easily.
Agreed. But what you mentioned when you were talking about the cloud actually is unthinkable complexity.
Oh, yeah.
So we are in a certain sense living in a world that we cannot comprehend anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. It's also dominated by software constructs that are now becoming opaque to human beings. A brief recap on the history of artificial intelligence research. Since the field of AI first emerged in the mid-1950s, scientists initially started looking at neural networks, which are software circuits designed to emulate neurons. Because obviously if you're trying to build an electronic brain, maybe you want to copy the way the brain works. And this field was derailed for about 20 years when a very brilliant computer scientist, Marvin Minsky, while pretty much a graduate student, came out with a convincing proof that one particular type of neural network, a perceptron network, was not a universal computational element. It couldn't actually perform general computation for perceptron. Now, this became the received wisdom that neural networks are no use, they're a dead end, until the 1990s, the late 90s, when people began looking at what were called hidden layer networks. A perceptron network has two layers of neurons, a set of input neurons and a set of output neurons. Hidden layer networks have additional layers of neurons with crosslinks between the input and output layers, and were mathematically proven relatively rapidly to be general purpose computational devices, able to emulate a universal Turing machine. And since then, with the explosion in the power of our computers, which are still growing by roughly six orders of magnitude per decade, we've been able to build increasingly complex deep learning neural networks. Neural networks which you point at a database of, for example, millions of photographs, and they learn to they can be trained to recognize similarities between certain photographs. Or between certain other types of data. And this is upending a lot of our assumptions. We're now dealing with software that we do not understand that improves over time as the amount of data available to it expands, running on databases too big for a human being to comprehend. A few years ago, I saw a figure that we're approaching the photographic singularity. All our phones have cameras. And as of about 5 years ago, the figure was that something like a quarter of all the photographs ever taken had been taken in the preceding 12 months, and that this law has remained true for several years now. The number of photographs taken is expanding exponentially. They're being uploaded and stored so that 10% of all the photos ever taken are on Facebook. Facebook has a cluster of more than 10 million PCs just running face recognition algorithms to match faces in the background of photographs to names that have been tagged in other photographs. Interesting implication here. You may or may not have a Facebook account. If you don't, though, you have what's called a ghost account. Facebook knows that various people have listed you as a friend without realizing you're not on Facebook and don't want to be on Facebook. So in their social graph, in their spiderweb of connections, they know there is a node where there is no actual account, but there are all these inbound links from other people. You will have been photographed by some of these people on some occasion at somebody's birthday party or wedding or convention, and people like to be helpful. When they upload photographs of public events for their friends, they tag them with the names of the people in them. And Facebook can actually deduce what you look like by your appearance in the background of other people's photographs. And by correlating the GPS coordinates and other metadata attached to these photographs, they know where you've been. I'm sorry, I've lost the train of thought here, but I was beginning to get increasingly paranoid. This probably isn't a bad thing.
It's not a paranoia,
it's not true. Well, I personally do a job that requires being paranoid, so I mean, I can understand perfectly.
And your job is?
Cybersecurity, or whatever that means.
Yeah.
And by the way, I agree 100% with you on the term cyber, and the guys here probably remember a speech I gave a couple of years ago on the term cyber, starting about what on the hell does it mean, why it's been applied to everything from cooking machines to whatever.
I find network security a bit less pretentious and still describes the same thing. But we're living in a very, very strange era. One of the problems we've got is that the power consumption of our low-end computing devices has come down to microwatts in some cases, and the cost of producing a microprocessor has also collapsed to maybe 10 euro cents in bulk. Not a high-end Intel one that would power a PC, but a small embedded processor, like the ones in your smart color-changing light bulbs.
That's exactly. That's why we have smart fridges, smart.
We are living in a Philip K. Dick future where we can be held to ransom by ransomware running on the front door lock. Most televisions sold these days are actually reasonably fancy computers with an internet connection. And there have been cases of crypto locker ransomware hitting televisions that have unpatched security flaws. Again, Airbnb have been encouraging people to buy smart locks to put on their flat apartments. If you want to let your apartment out for a day or two by running an Airbnb lodging, you don't want to have to hand out a key and then have somebody pick the key up. You want them to turn up at the door with a phone that's been registered and suddenly the door unlocks for them. But a side effect of this is unpatched security holes in door handles. We're not that far away from ransomware locking your apartment and not letting you in until you pay up some Bitcoin.
Well, it's already happened. An hotel a few months ago was hit by a ransomware attack, and the hotel staff couldn't get people out from their rooms. It happened, really. So it was quite a problem.
I believe that was a hotel with a central lock control system.
Exactly.
Actually hitting individual households. I don't think that's happened yet, but I am kind of worried by all these smart electricity meters and smart door locks and smart light bulbs. And general word of advice, if you have an existing appliance that doesn't need the internet to do what it does, don't add the internet, because the company that makes it will be using really terrible software quality control. And once they've sold you your kettle with an internet connection, they have no profit in patching the security holes, and in 3 years' time, it will be hit by a worm that will start mining bitcoins on your kettle.
Yeah.
or sending spam.
Small thermostats, they know when you don't.
Yep, that too. Yep. I mean, I've seen some really stupid internet-connected gadgets over the past couple of years. There is the Internet of Shit hashtag on Twitter.
Yep.
No tiny children in here? Good. Okay. Internet-connected vibrators and butt plugs.
With camera, I mean.
With a camera in it.
With a camera, yes. Also. Yeah. Camera connected via Wi-Fi, by the way. Yes. We know it.
Yeah.
So we are talking about crimes. I wouldn't say cybercrime for the same reason we mentioned a few moments. But certainly we are experiencing new form of crimes that, again, in the past were only imagined by science fiction writers. I recall a movie called The Net in 1995. You know, this was, by the way, the first movie with Sandra Bullock as the main actress. And it was science fiction at the time. It described an identity theft, which was not common in 1995. I mean, the girl used to buy things on the internet. 1995, it was not so common. She ordered pizza on the net and ate it at home. And a certain time, a criminal gang decided to steal her identity. That was science fiction in 1995. It's, daily chronicles on the newspapers today. So also the crime world has changed behind the imagination of even the wildest, science fiction writers.
Yeah, a figure I heard was that between 10 and 20% of the British public are hit by internet fraud of some kind or computer crime or malware every year. In fact, it's probably the most common form of unreported crime these days. Sexual offences and petty assault aside, it's surprisingly common and is still growing. I've actually written a couple of computer crime novels some years ago, and unfortunately, setting it 10 years in the future is bad because my book, Halting State, which I wrote in 2006 and was published in 2007, is now a historic document. It was set in 2017 and almost everything in it has happened. I got some minor details wrong, such as the network quality of service required to allow the remotely controlled cars to be driven by human drivers in a central data center rather than by full autopilot. And I thought they'd be around a couple of years earlier than they are. And I'm not certain the NSA actually has a working quantum computer yet, but D-Wave makes some fairly wide claims. But everything else in that book has happened, including the competing hacker teams trying to do a capture of a flag for a small European nation. Excuse me, I think I'd rather be writing science fiction than forecasting on this level.
Exactly. So how can one possibly write science fiction nowadays?
Oh, now, I did actually have a recipe that was valid until a couple of years ago for how to write near-future science fiction. Let us suppose we want to write a book set 10 years in the future. There are three aspects to the future we're describing. Set in 10 years' time, we know that 90% of what's around is already here today. 90% of the people alive will be alive then, will just be 10 years older and grayer. Of the buildings have a life measured in multiple decades. Much of the architecture will be the same. A few will have changed or been replaced. There'll be some new buildings as well, but it'll generally look the same. Half of the cars on the road today will still be on the road in 10 years' time. They'll just be a lot older and rustier, and there'll be new cars as well. The shape will have begun changing. There'll be fashion shifts. Clothing is very, very unpredictable, but still is likely to be roughly recognisable in a decade, as it has been for the past 50 to 100 years. there are occasional weird singularities in clothing, such as the way men stopped wearing hats in the 1960s. But other than that, you know, wear a pair of jeans or a dress 50 years ago and nobody would look twice at you, other than possibly at slightly odd cut. Now, the next 9%, I've done not the 90%, the next 9% is stuff we can predict that isn't here yet, but that will be here, that we can say with some certainty. We can look at Intel or ARM's roadmaps and know roughly what to expect of microprocessors if we extrapolate 5 to 10 years out. We know roughly, if we extrapolate existing trends, how much flash memory storage will cost. We know what new display technologies are in the lab now and will be everywhere in a decade. We know what will replace our current cell phone technology and radio staging 10 years out and be trailing edge. We won't know what the bleeding edge stuff in the lab is like in 10 years, but we know what will be around on the street. And then there's the 1%, which nobody has a clue about. Trying to think of an example. Going back 12 years, because 2007 was a rupture point, thanks to Steve Bloody Jobs. Going back 12 years, smartphones. Everybody knew smartphones were the future, and they would have lots of little chiclety keys on them. They'd be sort of nubbly devices. And then the iPhone appeared, and they're all shiny glass slabs, nearly featureless. That's a trivial example of the unexpected showing up. You might have predicted something like an iPhone, but you'd have been going against the current of existing trends. Similarly, go back a decade, and nobody in their right mind would have predicted President Donald Trump. Facebook existed back then, but the massive abuse of Facebook for circulating fake news and individually targeting it at people, that was potentially there, but very, 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 very unexpected. And there's other stuff. I mean, 10 years ago, Elon Musk had just about put a satellite into orbit. He's planning on launching, I think it's 30 flights this year, but within the next 6 years, is going to have to ramp up to 3 orbital flights a week because of the amount of payloads he needs to put up, because he's planning on launching a 2,500 satellite cell phone network in orbit by 2026. He's got the go-ahead and the green light and is building the factory for the satellites. This is actually really happening. That's a science fictional thing that is going to have serious long-term consequences that we can't really extrapolate yet. Now, because of the weird disjoint that we've had, I think as a result of the whole deployment of deep learning and big data in the past decade, I now think we can predict 80% of the future accurately, guess at maybe another 10%, and there's a whole 10% 10 years out that's who ordered that, stuff that we just can't predict. Again, looking back 10 years, nobody really predicted Bitcoin. Especially nobody predicted that Bitcoin would be beloved of neo-Nazis because they all believe in the conspiracy theory that Jews control the global central banking system. Bitcoin is decentralized, therefore Bitcoin isn't part of the Jewish conspiracy. Invest in Bitcoin, comrade. Yeah. And as if that's not enough, really nobody predicted Dogecoin or Dogecoin. I mean, this is what I mean when I say it's getting really hard to predict stuff. Things are definitely going weird. And I think a chunk of it is because we're now in a world where a lot of the shape of what's going on is dominated by these really, really, really opaque bits of software that are showing eerily intelligent behavior. Again, Cambridge Analytica's ability to look at people's Facebook profiles and their list of posts they liked and eerily identify their political affiliation and what ads to show them to skew them to vote in a given way. This is causing feedback loops. It's causing trends. It is changing the world we live in around us, and it's not a human-influenced one. It's not artificial intelligence like HAL 9000, a human voice and a human mind trapped in a box. It is something very, very inhuman indeed that isn't conscious. Its motivations are that of the people who give them the training data sets, and the outcomes are bizarre, very often encoding existing human prejudices in algorithms. As an example of that one, Hewlett-Packard had a problem with a webcam a couple of years ago. It couldn't focus properly on black people. They'd only tested its color balance on white engineers. When they started trying to sell it, they were getting an awful lot of returns. This is an example of, I guess, racism being trivially encoded in hardware, but we see it elsewhere in bank loan application software that discriminates against people based on where they live or on other attributes that are culturally determined or that correlate with a particular subculture. Cambridge Analytica is sort of taking this to its logical conclusion and cultivating racists, but it would be very interesting to look at the data they use, they're training their stuff on. Sorry, you have something to say?
Yeah. On what you're saying, it seems to me that extrapolation is not the right way to predict the future. I mean, in the 60s, the most scientifically accurate science fiction work at the time, 2001, I mean, Space Odyssey, predicted that those days we should have 1 kilometers long spaceships, and we haven't. They didn't had a clue on cellular phones. It was beyond every, possible imagination, because there was nothing such that before. So just by extrapolating the current knowledge, you probably are getting wrong predictions, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. The classic example of futurism gone wrong was a prediction in the 1880s that if the rate of use of transport in London increased at its existing rate, by 1970, London would be under 30 metres of horse manure. It wasn't. On the other hand, traffic in 1970 travelled no faster than it did in 1870 because of the increase in congestion and the increase in traffic. It just went in a completely different direction.
So we should rather write fantasy and not science fiction or whatever. It's less prone to errors.
Actually, there's a lot to be said for studying fantasy. Fantasy very often plays off existing mythological archetypes and legends and superstitions and fairy tales. And these influence the culture in which our technology designers live. In many respects, our relationship to the technological world around us is superstitious. This is a computing device. I know it runs on magic smoke. There's magic smoke in it. If you put too much electricity into it, all the magic smoke comes out, and then it stops working if something goes wrong. You tell me how a video cassette recorder works. Our relationship with our artifacts is that we perform rituals on them, and they deliver certain outputs, and for most of the time, we do this with no actual insight or understanding into how the inputs relate to the outputs. Very often, our designers play to this model of interaction by giving us user interfaces which, when they're good, they encourage playful interaction where you explore, you give random inputs and see what the piece of software on your iPad does. Otherwise, though, it's sort of ritualized and very often reflects an existing technology that has now been superseded. If you look at Microsoft Word, why does this thing have a tab bar? What is a tab bar anyway? It's not a bloody typewriter, but that's what we're left with, because when the word processor was invented, it became a visual metaphor for doing something not unlike typing. Now, as our computing gradually becomes more and more pervasive and sinks into the environment around us, For example, smart thermostats. You walk into a room and the heating adjusts to your preferred temperature, or the lights come on. If a toilet's in here, you walk into a room and the lights come on for you. This isn't really very smart computing, but we can expect buildings that will anticipate our movements and our moves and other activities. As this happens, we're going to actually end up with an animistic relationship to the world around us, where we perform certain rituals in certain places, and the spirits deliver certain results that we've asked for.
Yeah. You mentioned artificial intelligence before. I was following those days a strong debate, especially amongst lawyers, who are always seeking who is liable for something that happens. And since, self-driving car recently hit a pedestrian and kill him or her, lawyers are debating about machine liability or IA liability. And someone seriously recently proposed inserting in future artificial intelligence some very low level basic constraints in order to not let the artificial intelligence do any harm to human people. That has been written 50 years before. Those are the three Asimov's laws of robotics. Isn't that ironic that nowadays people are seriously thinking, reinventing those concepts that was, common in science fiction since 50 years?
I'm actually very, very worried by Asimov's three laws, but I'll get to that in a moment. On a diversion, that impact in Arizona, the pedestrian fatality with the self-driving car, I'd just like to remind people, the car in question was an Uber vehicle under test. Self-driving vehicle manufacturers work to a metric of how many miles, this being America, they drive per human intervention required to prevent an accident. Google and the other self-driving car manufacturers like Tesla are looking at between 1,000 and 5,000 miles driven per driver intervention, where the driver has to hit the brakes or grab the steering wheel. With Uber, we're trying to make it to 11 miles and failing. Two orders of magnitude worse than their competitors. Something is very wrong there. That is a vehicle that should not have been on the public roads at all at that level of development. Now, getting back to the topic, though, Asimov's three laws, this worries me because, yeah, they were a good idea at the time, but one, Isaac Asimov, nice Jewish boy, grew up in New York in the 1900s to 1920s. In an America riven by lynching, if you read his early robot stories, robots are basically driven off Earth in an unpleasant parallel to American Southern racist riots. And what he was looking for was a way of ensuring that his tin slaves could not rebel. This is actually a really inhumane thing to inflict on a human equivalent intelligence, if it is indeed human equivalent. It's slavery with no mitigating factors. It is also, his laws were very, very high level directives with unpleasant side effects. One wonders what, for example, happens when you shall not let a human being come to harm through action or inaction, runs up against a woman who has an ectopic pregnancy and needs an abortion or she will die. Yep. Well, we've also got that problem with Ireland having a referendum on repealing their Eighth Amendment, which completely bans abortion. But forcing robots to make that decision, it's not fair on the human beings and it's definitely not fair on the robots either. I think the three laws of robotics need a really, really thorough rethink because I'm pretty sure I can, if I looked at them long enough, I could dream up scenarios for each of the three laws of robotics where they would cause human beings to come to extremely severe harm at the hand of robots. Protecting human beings isn't easy because human beings are perverse and do all sorts of strange, unexpected things. And coming up with simple mechanistic rules for protecting human beings, I don't think that's feasible. There will always be edge cases where the rules have to be ignored. I mean, that's why we have law courts.
On the other side, the European Union is seriously wondering if it could be possible to give robots a legal personality. It's a debate which is, seriously going on in the EU.
Yeah, and again, this gets into the very, very disturbing history of the legal doctrine of corporate personhood, which came out of the United States in the late 19th century. And a side effect of making corporations people in the law is that they have civil rights, such as free speech. But free speech means something completely different to a corporation with lobbying interests and a multi-billion euro turnover than it does to an ordinary citizen. One can argue a lot of what is wrong with our politics today in the democratic nations is down to corporations being treated like people for purposes of lobbying for political legislation on their behalf.
But again, lawyers just are always seeking for people to sue. They cannot sue a robot, so they seek to have some personality to sue.
I think a chunk of it is also abstract argumentation by lawyers, but yeah, we also get into other questions when we start asking about artificial intelligence. If you have an artificial intelligence, say a human mind in a box running on a single computer, let's keep it simple here, what happens if you switch it off? Is this murder? If you can start it up again, unfreezing it with its previous state intact, then you might argue that's equivalent to a general anaesthetic in hospital. But if it has to restart from scratch and loses information, then have you just killed it? These are moral and ethical questions, and you can't really answer them without some idea of the shape of the artificial intelligence in question. What exactly is it? What does it do and how does it do it? And to make matters worse, what we're getting from the field of artificial intelligence looks nothing like a human mind. It's a magic box you keep by your bedside that plays music and you can say, "Hey Siri, tell me the news." We don't think this thing is actually intelligent, but you could also tell it, play some music I like, and it will play you some music you probably like based on your information it has acquired about your taste from your previous requests. Where does it begin? Where does it end? You know, in some respects, one of these smart speakers and the cloud service it backs onto is more conversational than a pet cat, but on the other hand, it's a lot less lifelike than a pet cat. Is it alive? Is it not? Is it a legal entity? Who knows?
So the actual world is still interesting for a science fiction writer, isn't it?
Yeah. I mentioned writing a couple of crime novels set in the near future. The second of these was titled Rule 34. Rule 34 of the internet is, if you can imagine it, there is porn of it on the internet. And it was a crime novel in which the police in Edinburgh in the year 2022 have a Rule 34 squad who monitor internet, really esoteric internet porn and memes, looking to see if something that's probably criminal is actually happening in their turf. And they come across a string of really, really, really bizarre accidental deaths, where people have died in accidents where there is no one obvious cause and nobody has murdered them, but a series of mechanical malfunctions have occurred and people have died. And they gradually work out that all these people in common had was that they were cyber criminals. And well, it gradually...
You said cyber, by the
yep,
way, yeah?
They're police, they use that term. And they gradually work out that there is actually an artificial intelligence system killing them. It is, however, a big data-based knowledge mining system that has been told to deal with spam and learn how to stop spam. And the way it is stopping the spam problem is by, well, as with many of these neural network systems, they learn to game the system. The way it's gaming it is to cause accidents to occur in the real world that kill the spammers. I'm reminded of some researchers who've been training neural networks to play simple board games in a computer arena, and they're training the neural network gamers against each other. And apparently some of them learn to cheat by overwriting the high score file. It's not good. More seriously, on my to-do list is to write the third Scottish crime novel set in the near future. And this time I'm going after brain implants. I should add, we do know that when US Vice President Dick Cheney had an implanted defibrillator, his defibrillator was designed so it could be fine-tuned and adjusted by radio control. The radio receiver was snipped out of his deliberately because of the risk of assassination.
It's a serious concern for, I mean, most governments nowadays. We are, I mean, most of our population is actually becoming cyborgs with implanted machines which are vulnerable, and that's a problem, and it will be a very tough problem in the few next years.
And some, while I remember, there's a really important thing I just need to mention. We have phones that recognize our faces now and recognize our voices. It turns out that their sampling rate is their senses are better than human. They can see into the near infrared and near ultraviolet. They can hear in the ultrasonic. So a new class of emerging security threats is things like ultraviolet LEDs that can project somebody else's face over your face as a way of logging into somebody's face-secured phone. By painting you as the owner rather than letting it see that you're someone else. Alternatively, using ultrasonic signals from televisions which are picked up by an app on your phone, a piece of malware, to direct ads at you and for ad tracking. Crossing the air gap, it's called, where basically a box may not be connected to the internet directly or even by wireless, but it can talk to the outside world by flashing its LEDs or by using its speakers to send ultrasonic inaudible noises and listening with its microphones.
By the way, one clever way of tracking what people is doing is via ultrasounds, which are received by the smartphones. And for instance, there was registered technology used to track if people is looking at advertisement on TV. You put some ultrasound with the advertisement when you broadcast it, and then if the smartphone of the people guess that the ultrasound, you know that he's watching this ad, and the feedbacks got, I mean, back to the producer, which is a very, I mean, disturbing technology.
Yeah. And it goes a bit further. And a scary thing about Wi-Fi is that the frequencies it runs on are absorbed by water molecules quite strongly. So modern Wi-Fi base stations with very high data rates often use multiple antennae and can do beam shaping, basically like a phased array radar kit. Some researchers at MIT have been working on firmware for Wi-Fi routers that will turn them into radar systems capable of locating the human beings in the building with them, even through walls, with an accuracy of within a centimeter or so. You know, imagine the police come with a warrant for your Wi-Fi router to find out precisely where you are in your bedroom when they come and break the door down. This sort of thing. This is not the future I signed up for, I'm afraid. Please can I have my jetpack and food pills back?
So better turn to magic instead of science or whatever.
Yeah, and I think we're nearly out of time now. Any last question?
The last question, otherwise we will say a big thank to Charles. It's been a pleasure having him.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks a lot, it's been a pleasure having you here.
Avete ascoltato Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache della galassia, da un'idea di Paolo Bianchi e Omar Serafidi, con il contributo cibernetico del Cylon Prof Massimo De Santo. Potete seguirci ed interagire con noi sul nostro sito fantascientificast.it, su Facebook alla pagina Fantascientificast, su Twitter sul profilo @fantascicast, sul nostro canale Telegram t.me/fantascientificast, sulla nostra community Telegram t.me/fsccommunity. Se siete particolarmente timidi, potete utilizzare la vecchia, cara e affidabile posta elettronica scrivendoci all'indirizzo redazione@fantascientificas.it. Tutte le puntate sono disponibili sul nostro sito, su Apple iTunes, su Spotify e su Podbean all'indirizzo podcast.fantascientificas.it. Se volete, potete lasciarci una valutazione a 5 stelle su Apple iTunes ed offrirci una birra romulana o un gotto esplosivo pangalattico, sostenendoci tramite una donazione PayPal utilizzando l'apposito pulsante sul nostro sito. Fantascientificast è una produzione amatoriale. Non si intende infrangere alcun copyright, i cui diritti appartengono ai rispettivi detentori. Autorizzazione SIAE 5612I5359. Nessun byte e nessun tribolo sono stati maltrattati durante la produzione di questo podcast. Alexa 4 e l'equipaggio di Fantascientificast vi augurano lunga vita e prosperità e vi danno appuntamento alla prossima puntata lungo la rotta di Kessel.
Settimo simbolo inserito nel computer. Blocco 1 pronto. Blocco 1 posizionato.
Potenza erogata 23%. Così.
Blocco 2 è pronto.
Attivato.
Blocco 2 posizionato.
Siamo al 35%.
Arme rosse, evacuare l'area intorno allo Stargate.
Liberate l'area, torniamo da voi, chiudo le porta.
Andiamo, sbrigate.
C'era quello sotto la grande pietra?
Sì. Mio padre lo trovò nel 1928. È fatto di un minerale che non si trova sulla Terra.
Blocco 5 posizionato.
75%.
Blocco 6 pronto. Blocco 6 posizionato.
Non eravamo mai riusciti ad andare oltre nella sequenza.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Coriant.
Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.